On this episode, Nick Molinar and I discuss web performance. Welcome to the Frontend Developer Cast, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at building ambitious web applications. Whether you're a JavaScript ninja or you're just getting started, I'm your host, Craig McKeachy. Hi, everyone. My interview today is with web performance expert Nick Molnar. Let's get right to it. This isn't just another Why Slow talk, though. Things are getting more evolved in this space, and I learned quite a bit from this talk, so hopefully you will as well. Here it is.
Hey, today I'm lucky to have Nick Molnar with me. Hi, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Craig. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on the show. Today we're going to talk about web performance, but why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself first?
You covered my name already, so that's good. We got the most important thing out of the way.
Did I say it right?
You did. Oh, yep, Nick Molnar. You got it. So I live in New York City. I've been there for about 8 years now. I've been doing web development for 18 years, so it's really all I've ever done with my life. I work for Redgate Software, working on web performance tooling. I would work on an open source tool called Glimpse, and I travel around the conference circuit in America and abroad, just kind of espousing the virtues of web performance.
Awesome. That's a great topic. So when you give your talks, how do you like to talk about web performance? Do you have a way you kind of can break it down? It's kind of a big topic, right?
I do. It's a big topic. I break it down in order of descending granularity, which I tell the people in my audience and the people that I work with when I consult that you really want to focus on the biggest problems first. All too often, a developer might be comfortable in JavaScript or might be comfortable in PHP. So that's the thing that they dive into when it's not necessarily the thing that their users are having frustration with. And so descending granularity means figure out where the pain points of the app and the user are having and focus on those first. And so with that blanket statement, usually moving things across the network are the biggest problems for performance. So that's usually where I start. And then I kind of break it down into three other areas after that. But with web applications, I like to think of the way we interact with the web in two phases. When the first time you type the URL into the location bar and you hit enter, you're quote unquote installing an application, right? So there's this installation phase. We think of that as the onload kind of thing. And then after that, the user is using the application. They're not necessarily going back to the server to get any more data or resources. And performance for the install experience and the usage experience, you kind of handle those two things differently. And so that's how I break it up into those two areas with two subsets underneath each.
I like that. So let's talk a little bit more about the network area. You know, I read High Performance Websites by Steve Souders, I believe it years ago, and used YSlow and stuff like that. But I think I'm falling a little out of touch with that sort of thing. How do you recommend to clients they take a look at network type issues nowadays?
Yeah, so Steve's two books are still the seminal, right? He recognized that this was the biggest area of challenge for users. So that's what he focused on. So all his rules really still apply, right? The standard stuff. Minify, combine files, reduce HTTP requests, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, with the tooling that we have, we're really starting to even think about more low-level stuff. For example, TCP slow start and how you optimize the content that you send down to the user and the size of it and how many packets it's taking up, because TCP doesn't run at full bandwidth to begin with.
Okay, so what does TCP slow start mean? You threw me a little on that one. That's a new one for me.
When the user agent, when the browser makes a connection to the server and the server's going to start sending content down, it has no clue what the network connection conditions are between the server and the client. It basically makes an assumption that it's in a really bad state and it'll send out X number of packets, some low number of packets. Maybe it's 1, maybe it's 10, but a lower number of packets. It'll send those out all, let's just say it's 1 to make the example easier on the air. It'll send out that one packet and then wait. Even if it has more data ready to send, it doesn't know if that packet made it to the client. It waits until the client receives it and sends back an acknowledgement. It says, okay, hey, that worked out well. I'll send out 2. And then it waits until it gets an acknowledgement. And so on and so forth, 2 to 4 to 8 and up. And so you can kind of think of the bandwidth as being increased over time. So it's really important to get basically the above-the-fold content, as much of it as you can, into that first packet, because you have to wait an additional round trip and all of the latency on that round trip to start getting more data.
Interesting. Yeah. So what are some tactics? So I think you started to get into it there. I've even seen some new plugins that people are taking the CSS that might be above the fold and pulling it, just that part of the CSS, into the page and the header so that the rendering experience is good.
Exactly.
What else do you see? Those kind of things?
Yeah, those are the kinds of things that you see the most. I see people who aren't going to be able to get the full experience in. They have too much data. They'll flush the HTTP response early. And so that does a lot of additional things that are really nice, but it's also warming up the TCP slow start, right? How many websites do you go to where the header of the website is basically the same from page to page to page? And so while the server is rendering the rest of the HTML or doing whatever work it needs to, you can send that stuff down and warm up the connection and get to a fatter bandwidth. When the rest of the content is ready, you can send that all down. So people do stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, use CSS. They have these grunt plugins and gulp plugins that will analyze your page and tell you what CSS you should inline. You know, it's funny because we learn these rules of thumb in general in all of software development. Like, this is the way things should be done. Like, normalize data in your database. But then when you get to the extreme of performance, no, you throw those rules out the window. Nobody is serving up normalized data, right? They denormalize it so it can be accessed and served quickly. I feel like this is one of those things.
One of those things, yeah. So what are some plugins? You said use CSS?
There's one called use CSS that is popular.
So it'll analyze your CSS and pull just the portion that's needed for the above-the-fold content into the header of the page,
yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah, and none of them work perfectly. So you kind of have to, you can look at the results of it and see what it's telling you to do. But then you have to use some common sense, right? Maybe you have some JavaScript that's changing something that it doesn't know. If you go to perf-tooling.today, They have a tools section, and it has a ton of tools, but there's probably four or five similar things like UCSS to go through and identify these kinds of styles that are important.
What's that URL again? I'll put it in the show notes.
perf-tooling.today, one of these new TLDs.
Okay, .today. Okay. So let's move on from the network stack then. What else do you see performance problems happening in a web application? What's our next lowest hanging fruit here?
So if you're doing a public-facing app, there's probably some server-side rendering of HTML happening. Because the browser doesn't really know what to do until it receives the HTML, that becomes the bottleneck. Right? I like to think of the browser, when you hit a URL, the browser is installing that application for you, right? And it needs a manifest of all of the assets, the JavaScript files, the CSS, the images that it needs to install. That manifest we call HTML. It's just a bunch of instructions of here's all the other things that you need to do. If we're waiting on the server to generate that, that is a problem. And so typically the reason why we wait on a server is because the CPU is busy. The biggest offenders of that are out of process calls, right? Going to databases, going to third-party services to gather that data. Those things are slow. So what we want to do is we want to get them when we have to and then cache them locally in memory as close to the server as possible so we can serve it quickly.
That's great. I really like that analogy of the HTML as a manifest of, and it is when you think about it, all the whatever script tags you have in there, the page comes down and then it realizes, here's what I actually need in order to do my job.
Yeah, it's a honey-do list. It's like, that's what my wife's going to hand me when I get home from this conference.
Right.
Go and do all these other things.
That's probably the same case for me. Yeah. All right. So you say out of process calls are usually what is the bottleneck on the server. Is that what the wording you use?
You know, if you're just doing CPU-bound work, it can be expensive and bad, but most of the apps that we're building on the web aren't, right? They're kind of CRUD apps. We're showing some data. That's easy. It's getting the data and going out of process to get that is
and slow. So tactics people commonly use is to throw a caching layer in there, so maybe they're not going all the way back to the database. What else do you see? Is there any, I mean, that may be the big one, but
caching is definitely the big one. The other things that I see is maybe they'll write it to the file system, so maybe that's closer, and then they will read that file. So some config file or a CSV file or a batch file that you get from some customer or something, you'll read that into memory, but you'll thrash your memory space. And a lot of web servers don't like their memory space being thrashed. And so they'll reset and you'll lose all your cache that's localized and you have to restart. And so streaming files in and reading them that way and using streaming APIs are much better than reading it all into memory and then throwing it away when you're done with it.
Interesting.
For less memory thrashing.
Interesting. You work on a back-end tool, though. I just work in the ASP.NET space for years at MVC, and there's a tool called Glimpse. You want to talk about that a little bit that helps with these backend sort of issues, I believe.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So you install Glimpse on an ASP.NET website, and it keeps track of these out-of-proc calls that are being made, as well as various aspects of the framework. So most ASP.NET developers are using an MVC framework, right? So there's a model of view and a controller. And so we instrument how long it takes for the controller to execute, how long it takes for the view to execute, how long it takes for every database query to execute. And then when the page renders in the browser, we inject a little widget with JavaScript right into the bottom of the page. So you can see for the request that you just made, that link you just clicked on, it did 3 database queries, and it took this long to render the view, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can start to compare and contrast pages and see which ones are fast and slow and where that bottleneck is coming from. You can go focus on that method and improve the code there.
Okay. How does someone hook that up in an ASP.NET application? Is it simply, how do they get it installed and set up?
So in .NET, we have a package management system very similar to NPM that we call NuGet. And so all you have to do is go into your project and NuGet install glimpse.mvc5 or whatever version of MVC you're using, 4.3. And that's it. It will make a change to your configuration file for you. It'll drop down the assemblies that are necessary. And when you deploy, you're running. It's that simple.
Is this an open source project? I know you work at Redgate. It's an open source project?
Yep. So Redgate sponsors Anthony and I to work. So Anthony is my partner. Redgate sponsors us to work on Glimpse full time. And it is open source, available at github.com/glimpse.
Okay.
Is where the organization is. And you can find all this information on our main website, including videos to see how it works and how to use it at getglimpse.com.
Cool. So what's our next level of things we should look at when we're talking about web performance here?
So we talked about the manifest file and the installation experience of the website. Once it's installed, then the user needs to use the website, right? And so now we're no longer talking about what the CPU on the server is doing, but we think about what the CPU and the GPU on what the client is doing. So we think about JavaScript, we think about CSS, and how efficient we're being with those things. What's really interesting is the same kind of tooling that you would use on the server, a CPU profiler like the one that my company makes, and the CPU profiler that's built into all the developer tools is basically the same thing. You open up the dev tools, you go to the profiler tab, you run that CPU profile. It will keep track of how taxed the CPU is at any given time, and then show you what the call stack was when the CPU was taxed. So you can see what methods are taking a lot of time and which ones are running rather quickly, and prioritize and fix the ones that are slowest first, obviously.
Okay, and there's snapshots in there, right? Like usually I think I've used them.
Yeah, so snapshots are for memory profiling.
I've gotcha.
So memory profiling and CPU profiling are generally two different concerns. You can have memory problems and be fast, and you can have memory problems and be slow. So it really kind of depends on what your app is doing. I tend to work on a lot of businessy apps or e-commerce, things like that. We don't really have long-lived pages, so we don't run into very many memory problems. If you're working on something like Gmail or a game or something, or maybe like the Slack client that you expect to be in the browser for a long time, memory management becomes much more important.
I get what you're saying. Yeah, so in my area of focus with these JavaScript MVC frameworks, that's why I'm always thinking about the memory profiling, because it's very easy for that page, that single page, to live for hours or days on end, and then you might want to take some snapshots of your memory. But you're saying in a traditional server-side web application, which I think the majority of people are still building here, is that the CPU rendering is really the thing you want to look at next, right?
Yeah, that's going to be what's really affecting the speed, how snappy the application feels to the user. They might have sufficient memory, and so I'm not saying that it doesn't matter, right? Because what happens with memory is you get memory pressure and then the garbage collector starts to run, and that will cause CPU problems, right? So you don't want that to happen, but you might be in a state where the garbage collector is not running, and so you need to look at your own code to see what's slow.
What are some common things you see that are, you know, refactorings, things that people might be able to improve on that they end up doing when they look at that CPU? Like, is it usually just, you know, it seems like it's a pretty generic statement. Well, you've got problems with JavaScript code, but what do you see people doing to fix those issues? Is that a tough one? Because it's all kinds of things all over.
Well, so
the board.
There's certain things that are just bad practice in general that you should avoid, right? So managing your scope appropriately, you know, knowing when to use the var keyword and when not to, making sure that you're only closing over the data that you need, because the way that scoping works in JavaScript, when you create a closure, you are adding another level of that scoping. And so that can slow down accessing that memory. That's obviously bad. So just being diligent about those kinds of things. There's just things you probably should never do that in JavaScript. There's the with keyword, right? And it's just syntactic sugar. It makes it easier for me to type out and change a bunch of properties on an object. I could do a little bit more typing and not allocate a new scope the variables are stored in. So the with keyword basically, in my opinion, should never be used.
Right.
Just throw it out.
So really we're talking about, hey, look up JavaScript performance in general, right? Like just pay attention to good JavaScript coding practices and a lot of these issues will go out the window, or look at what you're doing versus what people are saying or good JavaScript coding practices.
It'll be that, or it will be bust out your algorithms textbook, or you know, go watch the MIT course that's for free online and understand the algorithms that you're using and see if there's a way that you can do what you're trying to do more quickly, right? So maybe it's you're looping over something and you're getting n log n, and you could do log n or whatever it would be to make that algorithm faster. But that's super specific to your data structures and to your application.
That makes sense.
The other thing that usually people have problems with is when they start reading or writing from the DOM. They're like, oh, that's really slow. Actually, it's funny. If you look at recommendations in general on how to write faster JavaScript, they'll tell you to avoid the DOM, which I think is pretty stupid. The reason why I write JavaScript 90% of the time is to get input and show output to the user, and that's all with the DOM. I think that that's oversimplified advice. The reality is we need to understand how accessing and writing to the DOM affects performance and the ripple effect that that causes in all the different browser sub-engines, like the layout engine and the rendering engine, and when we change the size of a div on the screen, what it's doing to the whole kit and caboodle.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? You know, I hear more and more, like, you know, I think when I first heard about React.js, that was the first time I heard people talking about, you know, how many frames per second does this, you know, we can render in. And it was a new world to me at that time, but you hear about it more and more. I think the, you know, the famous framework is doing some, you know, sort of revolutionary things in this space. So I think a lot of developers need to understand that better, you know, that how to read that stuff, how to look at it and make sense of it. Can you give any advice there?
Yeah, you know, I'm in the same boat as you. You know, I never really played video games growing up. In college, my roommate would be like, oh, I have the new Max Payne and I'm getting blah, 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 frames per second. I'm like, I don't get that. Duck Hunt didn't have frames a second. You know, I didn't worry about
yeah, exactly.
It. Exactly. So, but yeah, the tooling in the browsers is now exposing this data to us. So it's the first time that we can think about it. But basically what it boils down to is it boils down to the hardware and our screens, right? My laptop, your laptop, our phones, all of these things typically run at 60 hertz. Which means that all the pixels on that screen are refreshed 60 times a second. So if we take 60 times, a second is 1,000 milliseconds. So we do the division, that comes out to about 16 milliseconds, 16.6 whatever milliseconds in between screen refreshes. So if we're changing the screen, we're animating something in JavaScript or CSS or resizing something, whatever it is that we're doing, even if we're just replacing text, right? It's not even an animation. We need to do that work and all the ripple effect that I'm talking about within that 16-ish millisecond buffer. Otherwise, the browser will drop a frame. It will say, okay, you're not ready for me to paint yet. I'm going to wait. And it can't just pick up when your work is done, right? This is like VSync hardware stuff. It's going to run it at that tempo of 16 milliseconds over and over and over and over again. So when we hear about drop frames or my frame rate is low, it's because our work is taking too long and the browser's not ready to paint yet.
So what happens? The browser just chooses not to repaint and the user gets an unresponsive experience? I'm not quite following.
Yeah, exactly. We should probably be using Request Animation Frame API, okay, which is an API that takes in a callback and essentially tells you, the web developer, I just finished painting a frame. Go do work. And we use that API to get the most amount of budget possible, to get as much of that 16 milliseconds as possible, right? We could just wait around for a user to click on a button, but none of my users click on buttons in 16 millisecond intervals. I'll click like right in the middle, and now I only have 8 milliseconds. So I'm losing part of my budget. So Request Animation Frame, let's say that that's giving us the full 16 milliseconds, but my work takes 18 milliseconds.
Okay.
So we come back around at the end of the first 16 milliseconds. I still have 2 milliseconds worth of work left to do. So the browser says, okay, I'll wait. So my 2 milliseconds goes by. I've finished. We have 14 milliseconds that we're waiting with nothing happening. Our work is done, but the browser kind of has to cycle back around to be able to do that paint. And so that doesn't sound so bad when you're talking about maybe 14 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about dropping 2 or 3 frames and now users can start to notice these things, it becomes very bad. We get the phenomenon known as jank. I'll call it janky. And you can really see it on underpowered devices like your mobile phone. It, particularly, you'll notice it if you're scrolling. If you put your finger down on the screen and you kind of scroll from the top to bottom, and the pixel right underneath your finger doesn't stick to it. Your finger gets down to the bottom, and then that pixel kind of catches up after, and it's kind of stuttery. That's jank, and that's you dropping frames. And so that happens when you're scrolling and animating and things like that.
Interesting. I mean, so that's the best explanation I've heard of that. I'm glad.
Good.
You could offer that. So anything else we should cover? Anything else you want to talk about?
I'll mention something with CSS. So the dev tools now will allow you to go into a timeline mode where you can turn on the page and start scrolling the page or let some animation run or do whatever the work is that the page needs to do visually. And it will show you all of the frames that it painted with a bar chart and how long each one of those frames took. So you can see if you're hitting that 16 millisecond number and getting 60 frames a second or not. 60 frames a second, anything better than that, we don't really perceive. That's like smooth as butter, right? That's the experience that everybody is shooting for. Because I said there's this ripple effect, right? If I manipulate something on the DOM, I'm just going to do something simple and change the size of a div.
Okay.
Because I've done that, the layout engine in the browser that calculates the geometry, right? It calculates the skeleton of the page, figures out where all the boxes go. They have to recalculate the page because I moved that div, that might have wrapped something, a float might have been broken, right? The whole page could change because I've made something 5 pixels wider. It has to recalculate all of that. And once it's recalculated everything, it has to repaint the whole page, right? So my simple little JavaScript change of making a div 5 pixels larger could take 40, 50, 60 milliseconds. Because of all of this corresponding work. So these browser tools that show you these bar charts tell you where that time was spent, which is really handy. And so what it comes down to is depending on what properties you're changing. Like I mentioned width, that was my example. Width is one of the box model properties. All of the box model properties will affect the layout engine. Anytime you affect the layout engine, the paint engine has to clean up afterwards. So layout is always followed by paint. But some properties like color, that doesn't affect layout at all. So you can skip a whole step there and just go straight to painting and changing the color. That's probably or theoretically could be more performant. You have to test on every site, right? And then there's some jank-free properties like opacity. And these are specifically handled by the GPU. And so they go straight to the compositing layer, which is kind of a third and final layer. So I want to mention a website called CSSTriggers.com, which shows for every CSS property which subcomponents of the browser will be affected. And so it's kind of like, oh, I'm moving a lot of things around. I'm using widths or heights or whatever. And you'll see, oh, yeah, I'm thrashing the layout.
Interesting, interesting. CSSTriggers.com.
Yeah, yeah. So I know this is kind of all hard to
talk about
visualize on a podcast. Yeah, I do a presentation at conferences called Full Stack Web Performance. It's a blitz of an hour where I cover all of this, showing a lot of demos. It's very demo driven. And so that's available online and I can provide that URL.
That'd be great.
It's on my blog at nickcodes.com. And that might be a place to watch and get started with all of the stuff. It's also on that Perf Tooling Today, that the video is up there as well.
Okay, so nickcodes.com is where we can find all this stuff.
Yeah, nickcodes.com.
Yes. N-I-K, yes. Yeah. No, that's right. No one will get that right the first time.
No, they won't. That.
Yeah, come check out the show notes and you'll get that URL if you're in the car listening to this or something like that. So thanks for coming on the show today, Nick. It was a great talk.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Frontend Developer Podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast by going to the iTunes store on your phone or desktop, then searching for Frontend or via RSS by going to frontendcast.com, where you'll also find show notes and a full transcript of each episode. You can also sign up for my free AngularJS, Backbone, and Ember crash course. All of them solve the same problem, so why not learn them together? See you next time.